This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with the Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tantalk Radio Network Studio in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And the perfect place for readers to hear about the backstory of a novel. One of the things that I know that I've been talking to a lot of readers lately, and they all tell me that they so enjoy hearing from their favorite authors just to find out where they got the idea for a book. And it's funny. Some novelists know exactly the exact moment when an idea for a book hit them, and some it's sort of been germinating in there for years. But they always like to talk about it, and readers find it interesting. So I hope that all of you who have I've received some very nice emails, and I want to thank you for making suggestions about writers that you want me to interview. I know that all of you out there have favorite writers, and all you have to do is email me, and I will invite them. One of the authors that is going to be coming on March 14th is Margaret George, and she is back by popular demand, particularly from one of my listeners, Mickey, who is such a big fan of Margaret's. And so I was really excited that, again, I will have Margaret George on. She's going to be talking about her newest release. It's called Nero. And as always, Margaret George, who wrote Elizabeth, I'm sure has come out with a brilliant book. She's a wonderful historian and a writer who can really capture a period. So I'm particularly interested in to see how she's captured her previous books. She did Henry VIII, of course, and Elizabeth. So she was right there in Tudor times. And now I'm interested to see how she's captured Rome during the time of Nero. So that's very exciting. And I'm looking forward to that. At the bottom of the hour, I'm going to have a very interesting writer on Alex George, and we're going to be talking about his latest book, Setting Free the Kites. But first, I want to talk about a couple of things. For the most important thing for all of you out there, if you have written a book and it's not published, it hasn't been published yet, or a short story, or a poem, or just about anything, it's probably covered in the Writer's Digest contest, which is coming up. There are two really great contests for writers, the San Francisco Writers Conference and the annual writing competition that's put on by the Writer's Digest. The deadline for it this year is May 5th, so you have some time, but the months and the weeks go quickly. So have a look at it. Go just to writersdigest.com. They have all the details in there. Of course, this is the prestigious contest in the writing world. Not only do you, the winner gets $5,000 in cash, and of course is announced in a big hoop-de-doo when you win, but also the most important thing is that you get an audience with really top agents in New York City. So it's a wonderful opportunity for any writer. Now, of course, you might not win, but even if you get second place or third place or just place, you are ahead of the game because it is a something that you can mention in your query letters, something that you can talk about when you have the luck to meet an agent. So just try it. You never know. You know, there are readers, the people who read for these contests are open and are looking for something that will just grab them. And so if you feel that you've written something and it's really good and you should know it, then submit it. And sometimes it's a matter of luck. I mean, you might write a story that has a theme that a particular reader might just go head over heels in love with it. And this happens all the time. So try it. Go to the webpage, writersdigest.com. Look at the rules, and there are all sorts of prizes. It goes all the way down to fifth prize, actually, and then you can play. So do try it. It's an opportunity for you. And one of the things, of course, what it does, just the preparation for entering, focuses your mind on what your work is. I'm sure before you enter anything, you'll go back over your work, and you'll say, oh, I can fix this before I send it in. And just that process stimulates the mind. So try it, and good luck. And if you place, if you get some prize, make sure you call, and then you can come on the radio program here and talk about it and tell us, which step along the way this is in your career. Because for all writers, it is a matter of one step at a time. And particularly for indie authors, who you are not agented yet, you want to sort of work your way around it or up the ladder. And so entering a contest is a good way and a good possibility for you to make a name for yourself. Anyway, so I like the idea of the Writer's Digest contest. Meanwhile, I want to talk a little bit, writers, for those of you who haven't written your book yet, get to work and start writing, because it's fun. It is just wonderful to get your words down on paper. For those of you who are already writing and you have your book, there are so many things that a writer has to be able to do today. Now, of course, at all times, writers, if they wanted to really make a success of themselves, went out there and met the public and pushed themselves. Dickens did it, and Mark Twain did it. But in the past, of course, most writers had publishers who pushed their books. I can't imagine some of the writers in the past being that excited about going out and pushing the books themselves. But today, a writer has to push their book. And of course, whether you publish it as an indie or you go to a publisher, there are many steps that you have to go through. And I was I have very mixed emotions about an article that I just read this week, which is like another thing that a writer has to face. And you have so many problems, sometimes just problems of getting your book out there and on the shelf. And of course, it's whether if you're publishing it independently or through a publisher, you have to go through editors. And of course, a publisher, you go through many editors. And that's why I know many of you have given up on trying to find a publisher and have published independently because of the fact that it does take a long time with a publisher. From the time that you get an agent who is going to sell your book to a publisher, it's going to go through so many hands and such a process that it's at least a 2-year process from the time that you think, you're ready to go to the time that it actually starts moving and that it's on the shelf. But the latest sort of crinkle in this entire process is something that I was surprised in a way that they started writing about this so openly, because it's been sort of a hidden secret for a while, and now it's coming out. And I think part of the reason is because what happened to J.K. Rowling's. And this is the idea of sensitivity readers. And now for a published book, one that goes through one of the major publishers. Now, I don't know if all of them are doing it, but I know some of them are doing it. And they now have sensitivity readers. Readers who read line by line, word by word, looking for anything that might upset anybody. And then confronting the writer and saying, this has to be changed. I don't like this. I mean, I think that one of the things, writers cannot always be held responsible for what their characters say. If you have a character in a book who is really an obnoxious, rotten, horrible human being, and that character uses really disgusting language or insulting language or just is just so obnoxious that you can't stand it, the fact is that's the character. It's not the author. So if the author puts words into a character's mouth that you might not like, it doesn't mean that the author is thinking that way. The author is trying to make a point that there are obnoxious people in this world and they say bad things. But there are so many books in the past. If you go back through history and you read a lot and you say, wow, you can't have this. You can't say that. You can't do this. Of course, we saw that with Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer. But not just that. I mean, it's all types of things. There are many books that are classics where words are used that we don't like, and words are insulting, but it made the book. So it's a little bit scary when they now have these sensitivity readers. And from what I understand, they're not well paid, but they're enthusiastic. And that scares me. I'd prefer a very well-paid sensitivity reader who isn't enthusiastically looking for something. So for $250, they pay somebody to read a book word by word and mark down any word that they think objectionable. So I don't know. I don't like it. J.K. Rowling, of course, she got criticized, and why all of this started to come out, I think, is because she got criticized by Native American readers and scholars for her portrayal of Navajo traditions. Now, so she made mistakes. This happens. Writers make mistakes. I mean, one of the things I have always done, and I, of course, everybody knows that I've read 10,000 books. Half of them are in my house. A good portion are stacked up next to my reading chair. Many of them, of course, are reference books. And I was talking to an author, Bonnie Paul, and she had written a book about Lincoln's Neighborhood. And I mentioned to her that one of the things that I do is I keep her book next to me because it's a great reference book. And I love reference books because as I'm reading a novel, if a question arises in my head, is this accurate? I look it up. I do research. And many times in my life, from one little question in my head about a sentence, I have then gone on sort of a mystery tour, reading book after book after book until I've sort of discovered if that was actually true. And that's part of the fun. I mean, that is what stimulates you. So I don't know what her mistakes were. I did not read this a story by J.K. Rowling called History of Magic in North America. Okay, so she made a mistake. And it wasn't the end of the world. As a matter of fact, then if you find that she made a mistake, you can write an article about it. Or actually then write a book about how J.K. Rowling made a mistake. And then maybe you'll have a bestseller because everybody wants to read everything about J.K. Rowling. So it's a difficult situation for a writer. Now, indie authors, of course, don't have this filter yet. And it scares me that maybe in the near future, they will be required. And this is not a good idea. I hope that we are not going to reach the point where every book has to go through a sensitivity reader, and worse, an enthusiastic sensitivity reader. I don't mind if people find mistakes, and if you find a mistake in a book that is a technical mistake, a factual mistake, and you write to the author, in this next edition of the book, they will often repair it and fix it. If not, you can go to Amazon and write in the there where you do the reviews, you can write, well, she got this date wrong. Okay. Or she got this detail wrong, so that people can then find out that something was wrong. But I'm really hesitant to approve this idea of a sensitivity reader for every book that comes out, because what happens is eventually all the books are going to sound the same because there won't be any mistakes. And part of the fun of reading is to find the mistakes that authors make. And it's a process, but I do hope that this isn't going to be too big of a trend. Now, I do want to introduce quickly a segment that is really very important. It's one of Robert Tannenbaum's recommendations of an essential book that everybody should read, and particularly relevant, because everybody seems crazy today, is this book about Freud. So we're going to go straight to a book buzz moment with Robert Tannenbaum.
A book buzz moment with Robert K. Tannenbaum, author of the best-selling Butch, Carp, Marlene, Champy series. Check out his latest release, Infamy.
Passions of the Mind by Irving Stone, I highly recommend to you. And it was published by Doubleday in 1971. Irving Stone is a brilliant, brilliant author. And Passions of the Mind is the life story of Dr. Sigmund Freud. And one of the reasons that I selected this book is that not only is it a fascinating read, but that if you could sum it up very quickly, Irving Stone captured Freud's methodology, his scientific method, the preparation with precision that he sought to search for truth about his theories of sexuality, of self-analysis, and tested his theories through this precision and research and the necessary corroboration that he engaged in order to deal effectively with persuading himself that his theories of ego and id are very real, and the motivating factors that deal with sexuality in a very healthy sense. So I had occasion to meet Irving Stone, and I asked him during the course of our conversation, how was it that you were able to get into Freud's mind when Freud himself goes through self-analysis? And during the course of self-analysis, and this was one of the end aspects of his investigation into the whole Freudian concept of understanding self. And during the course of his research, Stone wrote that Freud himself, going through self-analysis, almost lost his own self when he was totally honest about everything that he had done in his life and his thoughts and his aspirations and then misdeeds and those things that are part of the lives of almost all of us. And I said, but my real question is, Irving Stone, how did you survive? Because when we read that Freud almost lost his grasp on his being, how did you, Irving Stone, survive this? And he said, it was the most difficult writing I had ever done, and I felt myself slipping away as I was writing about Freud. So this whole analysis that he writes about Dr. Sigmund Freud, who was a doctor treating people, he didn't wake up one day and say, you know, I think that this whole aspect of sexuality is built upon A, B, and C. That's exactly not what happened. What did happen is the very same kinds of things that one goes through in, for example, preparing a business model, preparing a case for trial. It's a painstaking scientific method, trying to be as precise and honest and truthful with trustworthy evidence as one can be in order to see whether or not your search for the truth has meaning and is effective and is real. And that's why I picked this book, because it does away with the notion of having some concept, some form of ideology that sounds good, looks good, but in fact is just a facade, a straw man, if you will, that is pierced with facts, with reality, with truth. And what you want to have when you present a case, for example, to a jury, you want to have proof beyond any and all doubt when you try a criminal case, as I, in my own experience, trying scores and scores of murder cases, that is, as a prosecutor in Manhattan, you want to make sure that your evidence is trustworthy and that it is corroborated right down the line with other facts that are quantifiable. And that's exactly what Irving Stone writes about, that Freud went through during the course of coming up with the incredible theories that he has espoused, and which are very much part of the entire psychoanalysis that exists today. So that's, this book, Passions of the Mind, is exactly that. There is enormous passion involved in this story, and I urge you to read Passions of the Mind. You won't be disappointed, I guarantee.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Looking for a good book? Then get over to Miami Avenue Book Nook in Indian Rocks Beach. Check out the latest books from local authors like Angela Hunt, who wrote the book for the film Risen, or Bonsu Brenvick, whose books preserve the memories of the Bellevue Biltmore Hotel. What do you enjoy reading? A thriller? A romance? How about a mystery or a sci-fi? At the Book Nook, you'll find it all. Remember, one of the joys of life is to read. Located in Indian Rocks Beach, look for the blue building with the mermaid on the side. On the corner of Miami Avenue and 2nd Street, two blocks south of the post office. Open Tuesday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. and Saturday, noon to 4. And don't forget, while you're there, check out Miami Avenue's great collection of Florida wines, local art, and fantastic gifts. Miami Avenue Book Nook, where you will be inspired to read.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my guest, Alex George. Hi, Alex. Are you there?
Hi. I am, Patsy. How are you?
Oh, it's nice to talk to you. Well, your new book called, and I'm holding it up to the camera because we're also on podcast, is Setting Free the Kites. Very nice cover. And
thank you.
Wow. It's nice to talk to you. I love your accent. This is a yes. Well, it's so interesting that you are Englishman and you moved to America, and I come from the northern peninsula of Michigan, and my goal in life when I was a child was to move to England. And as soon as I had saved up enough money when I was like 21 years old, I bought a house in England.
Oh, you did? Whereabouts?
Sonning, near Henley.
Oh, my goodness. And I bought
St. Anne's Cottage in Sonning and paid cash for it. I walked in and I paid cash for it, £19,000 at the time. Oh, boy, do I wish I still owned that thing. Oh,
I can only imagine what that must be worth now.
Yes.
I know that area quite well. I grew up in Wiltshire, which is about 70 miles west of London, and so Henley is on the way. And I went to college at Oxford, so I know that area quite well.
It's a beautiful
part of the world.
It is, and I loved it so much. And it was my, you know, as a child, I was a great reader, and I read all the, you know, great English writers, and that was my goal. I was saving my money from really the time I was 13 to buy a house in England.
I love that story. How wonderful.
And it was just fantastic. Of course, I did find out afterwards, pay £19,000 cash. And I never thought of things, and I never knew such things as dry rot existed or wet rot.
Yeah.
I mean, it's bad.
All kinds of rot.
Yes, there's all sorts. And so I had it was a lot of fun, I will say that. But you, of course, you were a lawyer, a solicitor, or a barrister? Solicitor?
I was a solicitor, yes.
Solicitor. And you pick yourself up and you move to America, and of all places, to sort of the middle of America, Missouri.
Yeah, the middle of the middle. That's right. Yeah, I live in Columbia, Missouri. When I came here, 14 years ago. My son was just about to turn two, he's now looking at me very funny. He's about to be 16, and so hang on, let me make sure I've understood this correctly. You were living in London, and you voluntarily moved to central Missouri. And I think his plan is to do rather what you did and make the journey in the opposite direction as soon as you possibly can.
Yes, well, it is funny how our minds work, you know, strange ways. But, you know, so it was reading your book, you know, I wouldn't have known from reading your book that you were a British solicitor, but this is a really great book. I mean, you are a writer's writer. You have a way with words.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Well, and I will say on the issue of the sort of American, you know, an Englishman writing as an American, I do get a lot of help. Even now, when I write, and, you know, I've been here for a while now, but I still occasionally anglicisms will creep in to my writing, and my wife will go, "Yeah, no American would ever say that," and my editor will do the same thing. And in fact, and writing a book set in Maine, there's an extra layer of that on top of that, because there are certain words and phrases that are specific to Maine, or I should say more precisely, that Mainers wouldn't use. So, for example, I learned during the course of writing this book that Mainers would never say sea; they would always say ocean. And so it's a process to make sure that everything sounds correct, and that we, you know, it's all as authentic as I can make it. And it helps to have lots of friends who live there and people who have spent a lot of time there. So I've had a lot of advice. It almost feels like a team effort sometimes when it comes to getting the details right.
And not many Englishmen go around saying H-E double hockey sticks either.
No, well, and that was something, that's an extremely Midwestern thing, I think. I don't know if any Mainers would either, but it's the sort of thing that you might hear around here quite a bit.
Well, being from Northern Michigan, where half of the year was hockey and the other half was baseball. Yeah. That,
right.
When I read that, it gave me such a kick. Well, I loved the first chapter. And we can always tell a book by that first chapter if it really captures you.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so well done. And of course, as I said, in being a writer's writer, you have a wonderful way with a sentence, and to the point that any, you know, a general reader can read it and get the story, which is fascinating. We'll talk a little bit about that. But then a writer wants to go back and read it again and say, how did he accomplish that? How did he get that feeling across? So let's talk a little bit about the story. I'm getting more and more away from telling everything that happens. I got a book and I read it, and the first chapter so surprised me, and I was so impressed by it. And then I went to the Amazon thing, and they had the whole thing up there and gave away the whole secret. And I thought, oh, I would have been so disappointed if I had read that first. Because sometimes you have to, you know, control yourself, you know, because some of this, it's a process of layering, coming deeper and deeper and deeper into the story.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is. And yeah, you have to be very careful when talking about it. And I find that it's a very different conversation that I have, I mean, on today, which is publication day, and so no one's read it yet. Whereas in a few months' time, when I'll probably start going to book clubs, locally anyway, and discussing the book when everybody has read it. And of course, at that point, you can lay it all out on the table and discuss all of these, the plot twists and turns and all of these things. But yes, a degree of caution is always a good idea at the beginning of the process, because you don't want to spoil any of those little things that sort of lie lurking in wait for the unsuspecting reader.
It's the reveal. You want it to be right. Revealed in the right order, and you don't want to know in advance, because it is part of the pleasure of the reading.
Right, that's exactly right.
So but basically we can say that it's a coming. They are putting it out as a coming of age story in the 70s that covers two summers and.
That's right. Two summers.
And what else?
Yeah, and it's the story of the friendship of two boys, really, Robert and Nathan, who meet each other, in that first chapter on the first day of eighth grade, and they're rather flung together unwittingly by the unwanted attentions of the school bully. I think we can say that much at least.
Yes.
And it's really the story of their friendship, and they're very, very different boys. Robert is very reticent and reserved, and Nathan, in contrast, is outgoing and confident. And as Robert says at one point, he knew no fear, only hope. So two very different boys, and it's really the novel addresses their friendship over the next couple of years, and the way that those differences play out and the dynamic of that friendship is what the book is about.
Oh, that's nice. You say reticent. I love that. Most Americans wouldn't say that. That's so British. I love it. Now I'm having this horrible thing. I'm getting myself confused if I should call an Englishman an Englishman or British, because I now know that there's so much contention that if one is calling oneself British, one is not for Brexit. If one is calling oneself an Englishman, one is for Brexit. And
oh, really? In that case, you can call me British then.
Okay, so, but it is a thing that one now has to be so careful about. Well, of course, one has to be so careful about everything. Which reminds me, what?
I was going to say I hadn't heard that Englishman meant one thing and British meant
something else. Oh yes, that's the end thing. I'm still in contact with home, with the big H, as you people. so it's so funny. As a matter of fact, we will mention there is a disease in this. One character in this book has a physical impairment.
Yes. A terrible one. And it's something that I talk about. I mean, he has muscular dystrophy, which is just the most awful disease. And it's something that I read about originally a long time ago in an essay by a writer called Penny Wolfson, whose son suffers from muscular dystrophy. And the thing would not let me go. No matter what else I read, I kept coming back to this story, and it latched onto me and refused to give. And so, where, as a writer, you're never quite sure what you're going to write about next and what a good topic would be. But when a story does that to you, or a theme does that to you, then you should be paying attention. And so I did, and I thought, well, this isn't going to let me go, so I need to do something about it. So I discovered more about Penny Wolfson and discovered that the essay was actually extracted from a book that she had written called Moonrise. And so I read that book, and then I read another book, and then I read another book, and I educated myself. And I realized that this was just something that I had to write about. I can't explain to you precisely why, but it just moved me so much. It's such an awful disease. It's it's a disease that affects exclusively the young, and really people rarely live over the age of 20. And there is no cure. And there is also this terrible physical manifestation of the deterioration that you see in the child. And as the father of two children, I kept going back to, well, what would it be like to be a parent of a child who suffers from this terrible disease. And so that's why I wrote about it. I mean, sometimes, you know, you get to pick your topics, and sometimes the topics pick you. And that was one of those occasions where I really felt that I had no choice in the matter. It was something that I had to write about. And I didn't just write about it, of course, from the perspective of parents, but also from the perspective of the sibling, because Robert, who is the book's narrator, is his brother who has this disease. And you know, he's the younger brother. So he has lived his entire life in the shadow of this disease and knowing from his earliest memory that his brother is going to die. And, you know, that kind of thing does things to you, and it changes you, and it informs Robert's character in many, many different ways.
Well, of course, you handle it with a great deal of sensitivity, which brings up a subject that I've been really focused on this past week, because there was an article about it's been happening for a while, that publishers use a sensitivity reader to read their books to see if they're sensitive enough. Did that happen with you?
If it did, nobody told me about it.
Well, this it's
I haven't heard of that.
Well, it's really quite, in a way, I think it's quite frightening that they are now hiring readers, and they're saying, and there was a big article about it. You must look it up, because as a writer, it's something that we have to think about, particularly you tackled here. It's a theme that runs through your book, but it's not your entire book. And there's so much, your book has so many levels of and so much depth to it, but it's an important part. And of course, there is this growing idea that one should only write about what one has personally encountered. And one of the reasons that they're having now these sensitivity readers is to see if a writer handles a subject in the right way. And so I was wondering, in this book, which, you know, because recently several writers have had to rewrite their books when they've gone through this sensitivity reader, because they weren't, I guess, sensitive enough, or they didn't have personally the experience with it. And I'm strongly opposed to that, because it's like what you said, it takes over you. Something will take over you, and a writer will suddenly come across something, and it takes almost a life of its own, because it's a subject that somehow gets into your system, and you work hard to learn about it and to reveal it in the right way.
You do. And I mean, I'm slightly flummoxed at the idea that you can only write about what you've personally experienced. I mean, that means that there would be no more fiction. All we would ever have would be personal essays and nonfiction books. I mean, you know, Anne Patchett didn't actually paddle down the Amazon River, I don't think. And, you know, I mean, every novel that you can imagine would no longer qualify under that kind of test. I find that ridiculous. I mean, the whole point of being a novelist is that, you know, we have imaginations. We can put ourselves into positions that we haven't necessarily been in and still render a portrait of a character that is compelling and believing and true. And it's interesting how often I talk about truth when I talk about my fiction, because obviously it's all made up. But good fiction is always true. There's a great story I heard about Jan Martel, who wrote The Life of Pi, which I'm sure you know. And the story about this boy in the boat with a tiger. And he was at a reading once, and somebody put up their hand and said, "I just wanted to ask you, Mr. Martel, is this story true?" And he said, "Yes, absolutely, it's true." And then he paused and said, "I mean, it didn't actually happen, but emotionally it's true." And I think that is the key. If you are able to, as a writer, render emotions that resonate with the reader and that are true on that level, that's your job. That's all that matters. Whether or not I have run an amusement park is actually immaterial to whether or not I can write about it. It actually happens that I have run an amusement park, but that's another story. But you shouldn't be disqualified simply because you haven't done it yourself. Do I have a relative who's died of muscular dystrophy? Thankfully, no, I haven't. But I have done my research, and you know, and if it doesn't work, then it was at least a valiant effort. But this idea that you can only write about what you know yourself is ludicrous to me.
Yes, well, we're going to have to start reading these articles there must be a reason that these articles are coming out. If you check some of the major newspapers, these articles are starting to come out every few weeks lately, I've noticed. And I'm wondering why, like, are they sending us a message? But as I said, you've handled it brilliantly. And it's just part of the story. That's interesting that you have actually run an amusement park, because you write about this amusement park very, very nicely, too. So.
It was one of those things that I sort of, at the time, you know, I had been a corporate attorney in London and Paris doing, you know, these huge corporate deals. And I moved to Missouri and found myself, running this. It was actually a water park, the largest outdoor water park in central Missouri. And, you know, talk about culture shock. It was quite dizzying, this vertiginous effect of, oh, that's right, I'm doing this now. But, you know, I learned a lot, and I told myself at the time, well, one day I'm going to put this in a book, and this is that book.
Well, and it is a wonderful part of the book. Of course, there is this influence, and I think some of the people who have given you these nice reviews and blurbs mention, you know, the Gatsby-esque quality of one of the characters, and if and of course I think there's some F. Scott Fitzgerald influence in your writing too.
Gatsby is a huge influence. It's probably a very unfashionable view these days, but I think that The Great Gatsby is just about as close to perfect as a novel can be. I read it every year. I actually teach it. I love it. And I try to include or pay tribute to Gatsby in every book that I've written. This is actually my sixth book. But I never got there in the past. And always my rather organic, which is a nice way of saying chaotic, process of writing means that I always get blown off track, and whatever I intended to do, I end up doing something different. So this time I thought, well, come on, if you're going to do Gatsby, then do it explicitly. And so Gatsby appears in the novel, and Robert finds a copy of The Great Gatsby, and he reads it and realizes some things. And you're absolutely right. I mean, Nathan, I mentioned before, you know, Robert says at one point he knew no fear, only hope. And, you know, optimism is really Nathan's defining characteristic, this extraordinary ability to remain optimistic in the face of pretty much all evidence to the contrary. And there's a line in Gatsby where Nick Carraway says, Gatsby had, I'm going to get this wrong probably now, but an infinite capacity for hope, or something like that. And so there are parallels between the two. When I was writing Nathan, I thought about Gatsby, and I thought about his, you know, that purity of his conception of things, and so that was an important part of it.
Well, and I think as I said, from a reader's point of view, the story is just complete, full, and at the end you feel actually there's a fulfillment at the end. You feel, boy, this is great. And then for a writer, I'm sure any writer who reads this will say, this is great, and now, as I said, you have to go back and look. And if I went back and I'm like opening at different parts and saying, whoa, how did he do that? And part of it, I did see some F. Scott Fitzgerald influence in some of the sentence structure, I think. So, you know, maybe some scholarly PhD student can take this apart at some point and compare you to F. Scott Fitzgerald, and that will be a wonderful thesis, right?
My My goodness, I would love to read that. I think.
Oh, I'm sure you would.
To the extent that I mimicked his sentence structure, that's so interesting, because if I did, I didn't have the faintest idea that I was doing it. I mean, I guess if you read a book every year, maybe it's inevitable that some of these things creep in. How interesting.
Yes. Well, I can start pointing them out. I don't have time to write a thesis, and I don't need a doctorate, but there must be some PhD student out there who's desperate for something. And I think that's a good subject. I would do it, you know, if I was young and I had lots of time and a student loan that maybe someday my parents would pay off for me. I think I would love to spend time just reading your work and looking for all of that. I've just come out with a brilliant idea for some PhD student. Right?
Right. Oh. How interesting.
Oh, boy.
Sure.
Oh, this is going to be fantastic. And, of course...
I don't have to die first, do I?
No. Don't. Keep writing. Keep writing.
All right.
Let's keep this PhD... we have to keep this PhD student busy for years because they like to keep going. PhD students like to keep going and going and going. So, yeah, I think it'll work out fine. Now, one of the
it's
things...
Perfect.
One of the things, because this is a show for writers, and writers are always asking me, well, you know, how did he get this book deal? And is it true, is it absolutely true that you had this book deal before you even wrote the first sentence?
It is.
Oh, people... Well, some people just hate you for a moment, but it's just a passing hate.
Yeah, the story really goes back to my previous book, which was called A Good American, that was published in 2012. And that was purchased by Amy Einhorn, who at the time was an editor at Penguin. She had her own imprint, Amy Einhorn Books. And the first book that she published was this little known novel that no one's heard of called The Help. And when you first publish the book, first book that you publish sells over 12 million copies, then people tend to pay attention to what you do after that. And she's a wonderful, wonderful editor, and all of Amy's authors adore her without hesitation or reservation. And we still sort of get together occasionally and talk about her, because she left, and we all mourned for months. But just before A Good American came out, I had lunch, or breakfast actually, with Amy in some very swanky hotel in Manhattan, and just talked for 2 hours and said, this is what I think I'm going to do next. And it was more a question, rather than saying what happened in the book, it was a question of talking about the themes. And she nodded and said, well, that sounds very interesting. And then I had a phone call about a week and a half later with an offer from Penguin to purchase the book, which is amazing. But then I sort of had to realize that, okay, now we've actually got to write this thing. So it was, and A Good American, I took me 7 years to write because I didn't have a contract, and it was only when it was finished that we sold it. But this one was a very different beast because, you know, from the very day I opened up that first Word document and started typing, I knew that the clock was ticking and that people were tapping their feet waiting for me to deliver. So it was a very different kind of a pressure.
And knowing that you were going to have a bestseller, because I think it will be a bestseller, and probably, and the funny thing is, I think this is one of those books that they're going to pick up to make a movie out of. I predict that.
No,
or have they done it already?
No, they haven't. At least if they have, no one's told me. Maybe they thought, let's not bother him now. I don't know. I mean, I never have written with that in mind. I would love it. It's always interesting to see what people do with your work, even to the point of just listening to the audiobook and listening to the narrator of the audiobook take your words. And, you know, I always say, to when I talk to writers and I talk about the writing process, every sentence is really just a set of infinite decisions that you need to make. And the same applies even when you're not doing that, but you're just narrating it. And so listening to where the intonations and the emphasis goes is so interesting to me to listen to. And the narrator of Setting Free the Kites is this incredibly smart guy who has made so many amazingly good to see. I haven't listened to it all the way through, but what I've heard has been fantastic. And it's just, but it's also endlessly fascinating to listen. Oh, okay, that wasn't how I would have done it, but that's interesting. And it's very similar in a way to the whole dynamic between a reader and a writer. And, you know, I've written the book now. It's out of my hands. Every reader is going to read this book in a different way, in addition to responding to it in a different way. And, you know, one has to become a little bit zen-like, I suppose, about it all, and just go, well, you know, I've done my bit of the job, and now it's up to everybody else to read it. And every reader is going to bring their own experiences to it, and will have their own thoughts and their own reactions to it. And that's all. That's the joy of it all.
Well,
and now I have no idea what the question was.
Okay, and we are running out of time. It has gone so fast, and I wanted to talk to you about, I'm rather obsessed with a character myself, an Englishman, a barrister, and he's taken over half of my mind, and I have to talk to you offline and get your advice on that. But I want to thank you so much for being on today, and do you have a website?
I do. It's alexgeorgebooks.com.
Okay. Well, everybody can find Setting Free the Kites, which is released today. It's a really fascinating read. I think, you know, you're so amazingly talented. And all of my listeners will really find it interesting. And I love this Amy Einhorn. I have to talk to her. She's an amazing person, and you're an amazing.
She's wonderful.
Yeah, well, we're gonna hook up, and we'll find out all the secrets. She can give me some gossip about you. So, okay, I'm gonna have to have you back on because I didn't get to cover everything that I wanted to talk to you about. But I want to thank you so much for being on today, Alex George, Setting Free the Kites. It's available today. Read it and do a great review on Amazon for him. Okay, everybody? And thank you, Alex.
Thank you, Patsy. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, bye for now. Bye.
Bye.
Wow, that's nice. I like him. He's interesting. Well, I have to wrap everything up because everything's moved so fast. On Thursday, I have Mystery Writer of America Grandmaster Lawrence Block on. He's going to talk just about writing and how writers can improve. And that's what you want to learn from somebody like Larry Block, who is, I don't know how many books he's written, but he's written a ton, and he will have lots of great insights for you. Now, remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book or on stage or on screen. So take some time and start writing. And meanwhile, remember, don't let anyone steal your joy, treasure it, and share it. This is Patsy with a Z, hoping that you will say something nice to someone today. And I will start with Bobby in the control room. He is so cute, and he is taking over today for Big Ed, who isn't feeling well. And I hope Big Ed is feeling well soon. But it was fun to have Bobby in the control room today. Thank you. So thank you, Bobby.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Come back on Thursday for Larry Block. It's going to be a great interview. Bye now.
WTAN, Clearwater.
FM 106.1.
WDCF, Dade City, Tampa Bay. WZHR, Zephyr Hills.
FM 104.3.
Listen.